Welcome to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. This December 30th, 2014 edition of Nature Bats Last, like future episodes, is pre-recorded. As a result, there's no chance to take your questions on the air. Our theme song is provided as a gift, again with our thanks to Afrozen. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. Background music for a couple of our regular segments, including the one coming up shortly, is provided by 17-year-old Scottish teenager Rhiann Farrigan. This week's show on Nature Bats Last, we spend the hour speaking with Forrest Palmer, one of the voices behind our Breaking Hopium segment, and we'll cover a wide variety of topics with him, including resource scarcity, climate change, the global south versus the global north, distance running, and of course, Forrest's prolific Facebook posts, as well as his work on the show. Today's show will also cover drought in the Middle East, as well as the inevitable collapse of the industrial global economy. This will be our last episode of 2014 and our 21st episode overall. We'd like to thank PRN and all our contributors and guests this year. Y'all make the show dynamic, and we feel honored to have you and have had the opportunity to speak and learn from you. We're looking forward to a great 2015 here on Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. We'll start this show, like all, with episodes with some news beyond the mainstream echo chamber. Our first piece comes from Druth Dig, and it's by Juan Cole. It also appeared in Juan Cole's webpage. And the headline reads, "Did drought and climate change cause Middle Eastern states to collapse in 2014? And it reads, "The Middle East, from North Africa to Afghanistan, has seen an unusual number of governments collapse in recent years. Libya, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen have all abruptly come to something akin to failed states, and masses overthrew dictators in Egypt and Tunisia. It is unclear how strong the Afghan state is, which was built by the U.S. and NATO, but surely President Barack Obama, leading 10,000 troops thereafter he declared the war over on Sunday, is because he's afraid that the Afghanistan government's army might fall apart as well. Severe drought hit Afghanistan in the late 1990s as well as the early 2000s, contributing to the turbulence of the country under and after the Taliban. The drought has reoccurred in recent years. Heat exacerbates the effects of drought, so as climate scientist Michael Mann at Penn State argues against the NOAA study that did not find a climate explanation. Mann says, quote, "Most inexplicably, they pay only the slightest lip service to the role of temperature in drought, focusing almost entirely on precipitation alone. This neglects the fact that California experienced record heat over the past year, and it has certainly contributed to the unprecedented nature of the current drought," unquote. Climate change not only makes agricultural problems worse, it has a direct negative effect. When it's hot, people fight more. Journalists and the American public have a tendency to fixate on powerful dictators on cultural issues such as Islam and subnationalisms. But while it can't be any means to explain everything, they are neglecting the regional explanation that makes the most sense as at least a contributing cause, and that is climate. Likewise, Syria was gripped by severe drought in 2004 through 2011. The frequency and severity of Syria's droughts have increased dramatically, pointing to climate change as one of the culprits. When farmers don't have enough water, they're forced off their farms, becoming day laborers, construction workers in cities. But if there also aren't any jobs in the cities, they're displaced farmers, and they become angry and disappointed and begin protesting or even packing heat. The water shortages in Yemen are also a well-known problem. Libya as well suffers from declining aquifers and poor rainfall. The climate problems in the Middle East will only get worse over the next 50 years. And this, it is already pretty bad. This article is a prime example of the dominant culture, again, not being able to connect the dots. Climate change isn't part of the cultural narrative, so therefore it remains peripheral, of course, until it doesn't. Our next piece comes from King World News, and the headline reads, "Paul Craig Roberts' stunning 2015 predictions. At any time, the West can collapse." King World News spoke with the man who former President Ronald Reagan called upon to help save the United States when the U.S. was in the midst of the 1980 panic. Dr. Paul Craig gives a portion of his fascinating predictions for 2015 and also issued an ominous warning that the West could collapse at any time. Eric King conducts the interview, and he asks a couple of questions. His first question is, what are your expectations and your predictions for 2015? What surprises are in front of us for next year? Dr. Roberts replies, at any time, the Western House of Cards could collapse. It, the financial system, is a house of cards. There are no economic fundamentals that support stock prices, the Dow Jones. There are no economic fundamentals that support the strong dollar. To have a bond market in which the purchasers of bonds have to pay a fee in order to have negative real interest rate makes no sense. When you buy a bond, you are automatically getting back less than you paid for it. What sense does that make when the United States debt is exploding and when the money supply is exploding? It makes no sense at all. No American markets make any sense. They're all rigged. I think, as he continues, in 2015, the world will start to see a realignment of power as it drifts away from the West towards Russia, China, India, and the states who ally with them, such as South American countries like Brazil, who are tired of American imperialism. You will see a shift in the balance of power that will be unfavorable to Washington. The interview continues, in 2015, will gold price manipulation end? Roberts replies, what will end it will be when the West runs out of gold to deliver. When the Fed and the bullion banks artificially suppress the price of gold, it causes a greater quantity of physical gold to be demanded. So as they push down the gold price, the demand for gold in China, India, and Russia goes up. At what point will they, the Western central banks, be unable to make delivery? When that occurs, that's when the price of gold will break loose. The day the Asian demand for gold at the artificially fixed low price exceeds the ability of the West to supply the gold, the price rigging system falls apart. At that point, the price of gold can move instantly higher. He continues, I don't know what the ability of the West to continue making deliveries of gold is. I don't know what aspects of annual production are controlled by the West. Clearly, the price of gold being suppressed suppresses the ability to produce more gold. The mines can produce more gold the higher the price is. The lower the price, the less they can produce because of the cost of production. When Washington suppresses the price of gold, they drive supply down as the mining companies cut back production, or else they hoard the ore waiting for a higher price. Yet the demand for gold goes up. So when you have the demand high and the supply restrained, you are basically operating on stocks of Western gold. And where are those stocks, and how extensive are they? There's been a lot of speculation that the Fed used up the Fort Knox gold a long time ago, and even more speculation that they've used up other countries' gold that was deposited with them for safekeeping, such as Germany's gold. They, the Federal Reserve, can't give Germany its gold back. Why? The speculation is that they've used it up as part of the gold price rigging scheme. So if there are no stocks of gold to fill the gap between falling production and rising demand because of the low price, then at some point the system simply can't make delivery. When that happens is when the Western Ponzi scheme, falls apart. Dr. Craig Paul Roberts will be our guest on the show next month, where we can explore more of his predictions as the one he just made and that I just read. Should be a very interesting conversation, and it should be a very interesting 2015, to say the least. Well, let's get to our interview today. Our guest is Breaking Hopium's Forrest Palmer, and Forrest is an electrical test engineer from Houston, Texas. He was born and raised in Los Angeles, California, and attended both Louisiana State University and Cal State University, Long Beach. Outside of his job as an engineer, currently that is his means of earning his daily bread for survival, Forrest is also a social critic, online blogger, and pundit on a number of issues. Additionally, Forrest is part of a group, Working Kind of Green, with Corey Morningstar, which is an organization dedicated to the environmental movement and the enlightening of people about all the various forms of human actions that are leading us to the precipice of probable near-term human extinction. Forrest, of course, has been the primary voice and contributor to our Breaking Hopium segment and is prolific in his writing. The connections he makes between various elements and the relationship to the destructive dominant culture are something I learn from and look forward to daily. I often refer to him as the most honest man on the internet. Welcome to Nature Bats Last, Forrest.
Hey, Mike. Appreciate you having me.
I want to start with something that you wrote on Facebook about a year ago, and bear with me as I repeat it for you. It's something that I think really gets to the heart of the matter of what we're going to talk about with you today. And so I'll read it, and then we can go from there. You're right. Nothing like waking up in the morning feeling good about to do a morning run and then read this before you get started on your day. The funny thing is that whenever you tell the average American about stuff like this, the refrain is always, "You still have to work." We are facing impending societal, social collapse in every aspect, and after you detail and generalize summary of all the reasons why, the person who has no knowledge of any of it will look you dead in your eye and say, "Yeah, but you still have to work." This might be the most myopic, short-sighted, delusional response in regards to both the indoctrination process here in America and how it can have you causing the destruction of yourself and all that you love around you. People can't grasp that the world can't fall apart, and you still wake up, get in your piece of crap car, and they are all pieces of shit, no matter how expensive or luxurious they may be to the human eye, work in your more times than often than not, utterly meaningless and useless task, go home, commit yourself to your kids, your grandchildren, and your great-grandchildren to this drone-like existence out into infinity. Yeah, but you still have to go to work and just easily be replaced with the true meaning behind these words. I don't know shit other than what the culture has taught me about life, which is to do whatever task I've been trained for, and everything else will work itself out as it always has. Time to run. Hell, at least they can't take that away from me yet. For me, when I read that and I saved it over a year ago, I had to go through my notes. For me, this really speaks not only to me personally and why I did what I did in leaving my career, but I think it really speaks to the heart of the narrative of this culture. And as a citizen, as a member of industrial society, work, or in our case, employment, seems to be the motto. And the work, the harder the work and the harder you work at it, the better. It seems to be that people think that it will solve everything. And so why don't we talk about that as in its role in our society? What is the driving force, you know, behind work and our idea that, you know, employment is the end all?
Well, thanks for reading that back. You telling me that right now, I remember when I wrote that, and it's pretty much my feeling throughout any given day, okay? I'm sitting at home right now, and I'm talking to you on this phone, and I have a computer in front of me, and I'm going to eat dinner a little bit later and enjoy all of the things I've been able to accumulate over 42 years on this earth. But the fact of the matter is that the employment that I've had, I've been an engineer for probably about 20 years now, I haven't done anything productive with my life. And I did everything right. I went to, you know, like high school, and I had honors courses, and I went to college, and I got a regular 9-to-5 job, and I thought everything was going to be okay because I did these things about 20 years ago when I started out. It's only been within the past 15 years where I actually started questioning things. And you talk about employment and the fact that that is the thing that's driving us off of this precipice, which will eventually lead to total industrial collapse. That goes without saying that our current situation as far as our interaction with the earth and our work environment and everything from the way we grow our food to the energy that we use, it's going to eventually lead to our collapse, probably our demise as a species. And eventually this will happen anyhow, because if you look at any species that's happened from the beginning of time to now, they have a beginning, they reach a zenith, and then they fall and they collapse. So eventually that will happen. The only thing that's said about us is that we're doing it to ourselves.
Right.
Now, when I was younger, they said, okay, well, go to college, get this particular job, and don't worry about anything else outside of that. So we've all been indoctrinated into thinking that employment is the be-all, end-all, and that's all we have to worry about. Just go to your job, do your task, come home, and we will provide you with all these different resources that will allow your little bit of kingdom, your house, to be able to function until you don't have a job. Of course, as you see now, 2008, we almost saw the entire industrial civilization collapse right there.
Right. Right?
And that was just economically. That wasn't even saying like, okay, we won't be able to have enough fresh water, we won't have enough oil, coal and gas, or any of those other things. That was just, we don't have the finances available in order to provide you a paycheck to get any of this stuff. So what's going to happen once we don't have any oil? Or we're not able to get it at the rate that we get it now, or we'll be able to have a functioning economy. Because that's what peak oil is. People don't understand that. They think that peak oil is the fact that, okay, well, there's no oil anyplace. No, it's the fact that our economy is tied to our energy usage. Right? So when people look at employment, they think that it's going to always, consistently, permanently, in quotations, provide them with the availability of all these things that we've amassed over the past 150 years since we've had the Industrial Revolution. And it's anything but that case, as you know. So employment in and of itself, I mean, I think we can look at it two ways. One is I need it. Most people need it, quote-unquote need it, because we have to find some way to get our food. We don't grow our food anymore. We don't have a means of transportation like walking. I mean, the entire system is set up for petrochemical fuels. I mean, that's a given in and of itself. Everything from how we eat, how we transport ourselves, how we use anything in our house. I mean,
we're soaking in oil, basically.
Yes, there's no way of getting around it. Right. So in order to have these things, we have to get a job. And really, if you really want to get down to it, when you go in for an interview, it's really a determination whether you should live or die, right? Because it's not about whether you have a skill set or anything else or whether you went to college. It's just how well you show this person within an hour or 2 hour, even 3 hour given period, that you have what that person needs in order for you to survive on this earth.
Right.
That's the most insidious thing about employment. And that's regardless of whether it's a small business or if it's a multinational corporation, is always you need this in order to survive. And then on the flip side, no matter what job it is that you do, you're causing the destruction of the earth. You know, if you, sometimes we make deals with ourselves. We say, okay, well, I work for a solar cell company, right? I make solar cell panels, and that won't be as destructive. You're not concerned about any of the mining that's going on in the world away and young people being lowered in mines and having to get all these different resources. That's not a concern of yours. You're only concerned that you're not destroying the earth from a Western perspective, right? No one ever talks about that.
No, they don't talk about it. It's interesting, you know, you bring that up because I wrote an article, a couple of weeks ago, and it was about my former profession, being a teacher, and really talking about that as a teacher, you need to look at your profession as well and really be self-critical of it, because it got to the point where I realized in my own profession that I was the gatekeeper of sending kids out there and really perpetuating the destruction. You know, they had to go through me and get the, you know, that piece of paper, and then they can move on and go into debt and start consuming and start living that life that we all know. And so I wrote an article about that, and the response I got was interesting, because people's identity is so wrapped up in what they do. And so they cannot separate the idea that them being a teacher isn't necessarily who they are. And so when you attack or criticize their profession, they take it usually personally first. And I think we see that right now going on with the police.
Yes. If you look at the state in and of itself, and you look at how I've always dealt with the police as they're my enemy. That's mm-hmm. how I was taught growing up. So for me, the state is racist by its nature. It's always been, it always will be. I think that's mm-hmm. one thing that people need to start waking up to. And that's regardless of ethnicity. I tell people all the time, you will see the same need or even want for police in the inner city where I grew up as you would in a regular middle-class white suburb. They feel like you need these people there in order to have a functioning country. Right? And there's no, in fact, there was no word for jail or prison in Africa. And I'm not trying to aggrandize Africa, but what I'm saying is that that's never been the norm for how people view any type of punishment, where they just throw en masse thousands and now millions of people into prison cells.
Right.
And so, as you said, when people say, okay, well, you're talking about police, well, you're talking about that particular person. Well, even if you are a quote-unquote nice person and you've been married to your wife for 20 years and you take care of your kid and you do all these things great, that's fine. But your job in and of itself is to do something destructive to a particular community here in the United States. So you got no choice in the matter. It has nothing to do. I'm sure that if I went back 300 years, that there were some overseers on a plantation who were very nice to their wives and their kids and raised them right and everything was cool. But yet still, when they went to work, they still had to put the lash to someone like me, whether they wanted to or not, quote unquote wanted to or not. So somehow they had to make it right in their mind. Well, I'm just a part of the system. And you're right. When you introduce these kids into the workforce, that's what you're telling them, that their particular job is not only a part of them, but also it's inherently something good because it's legal. And what we found out over the past 300 years, since we've had a chance to look back at slavery, chattel slavery to be specific, is that just because it's legal does not mean it's right.
Yeah, and I think that's what I'm running into with people within my profession, is that they feel that they are doing something good for kids. And I'm not arguing that they're not, that they're, like you've mentioned, that they're good people, that they're good for kids, that they're reliable, that they're great role models. But at the end of the day, if it's your job to promote something that is highly destructive, not only to the planet, but ultimately, you know, to the children themselves, I think you're doing a disservice to not only the profession, but yourself and the larger community by not trying at least to make those connections. And it seems very difficult, no matter the profession, but specifically professions that I think people are providing a public service that has been, I guess, hero worshipped in some case. And I'm not saying that these professions don't receive fair criticism, but it seems like when you have to look into the mirror and do it yourself, that's where the disconnect seems to be, and almost it's almost impossible for people to do that. I find out that, you know, you either have to have some sort of personal moment that hits you, and that affects you personally. Otherwise, it doesn't seem to happen. I don't know if that's the, you know, the case from the people you experience in your daily life.
Oh, well, let me give you a quick narrative, a quick story. And it's about the movie Saving Private Ryan, right? That came out about 20 years ago. Anyhow, Tom Hanks, the modern day Jimmy Stewart, every man, he plays a captain as the head of this battalion. And they're given a directive to go find this Private Ryan. And he's the last surviving son of his family in Midwest, Podunk, wherever. And they go through this circuitous route to find him. And they say, hey, we have to bring you back so that you can be with your family and live out the rest of your life, right? And then Private Ryan says, well, I can't leave my comrades here. We're defending this bridge, and if the Germans get through, then there'll be this catastrophic event and all that. So Tom Hanks and his battalion, they stay there, and they help him fortify this bridge. And I don't want to give it away, but I'm going to give it away. In the end, Tom Hanks dies.
Right.
And he's talking to Private Ryan, and he says, earn it. All right? He says, earn it. Like, earn this life that I'm giving you by sacrificing my own. And then it fast forwards about, I guess, 50 years or something like that. All right? And Private Ryan is an old man now, and he goes to visit the grave of Tom Hanks. And he's standing over his grave, and he's just distraught. He's just, because he doesn't know if he, quote unquote, earned it.
Right.
And he stands up and he looks at his wife, and it's intimated that he's been with her for, I don't know, probably since he got out of service, probably
Right.
40 or 50 years. And he has his kids behind him and his grandkids, and it's just like this big family moment. And he asks his wife, have I led the life? And she answers, yes, like, of course. And then she walks away, and then he salutes Tom Hanks' grave, and everybody walks away thinking that, oh, this is a good guy. You know nothing else about him except he's a grandfatherly white man standing in a cemetery
Right.
for veterans. You know nothing. You do not know if he went off and worked for oil and gas and was drilling in Nigeria and putting oil in babies' riverbeds. You know nothing else about this person other than that. But yet still, you walk away from it thinking that he is a good person. Now, why is that? Because you, in the one dimension that you look at this individual, you see him as just perfect. They couldn't even dress him up in anything that was upper class, like a suit, a tie. No, no. You had to give him a middle class white persona.
Right.
That's why you don't question anything else. Of course he led a good life. He's not in jail. He's not on drugs or anything like that. And not only him, but he did the thing that's very American, which is that he had a family. And they're nice too. And the whole dimension is nice. So until people start to question that dynamic of what exactly is a good person and what exactly employment should be, I don't think that there should be employment. But that being said, the jobs, the work, everything is that we do around here is totally destructive to humanity. And nobody's asking that question because we look at things like that and we feel that is a display of what humanity should be.
Oh,
Can we change that?
and it's who we are. You know, like if for example, if you were a teacher for X amount of years, or you know, you worked as a police officer for X amount of years, you know, I think you saw this really with the Great Depression and the collapse of the Soviet Union, that the working men took it the hardest because they lost their identity. And so I think part of that is these guys, and it mainly is guys that I'm talking about that I run into, is they are so wrapped up in what they do, as you know, it's who they are, that in order to shift gears, it is almost admitting that on some levels you've made a huge mistake, or you're, you know, somehow a failure. And you know, that's tough.
Well, it's very tough, but that's the thing. What is a failure? See, in order for you to give up the whole entire paradigm of capitalist accumulation and this being indicative of this culture and how great it is and we're so much better than you, then you also have to question every aspect of your upbringing. And that's what people aren't willing to do. You have to look at everything it was that you were told by even your own parents. You might love your parents, but you have to question exactly what it is that they taught you while you were growing up. And most people aren't willing to do that. And it's not even a demonization in a lot of it, because a lot of those people are ignorant. I'm 42 years old now, and I remember being as a youngster and dealing with my mom's friends for the most part and people in my community, and I was told to listen to them because they were older than me. And out of respect, I did. Even when I was a youngster, I was somewhat cognizant of the fact, like, well, I hear these people gossip all the time. They talk about unimportant things. They're really not teaching me anything that made me a better person because they were ignorant also. But now that I'm 42 and I'm at that age now, I realize that even my contemporaries are the same as those people back then. So I just have enough knowledge over the past 20, 30 years or whatever where I can just pinpoint and say, okay, well, it's a cultural problem that shows that we're not really being taught anything that's worth a damn, be it in our own house, at our schools, or in our communities.
Yeah, I think I remember reading something from Al Franken years ago, and I think he was describing the difference between somebody on the left and somebody on the right about looking at America. And I think he said something to the effect that people on the right generally look at this country as a three-year-old would look at a parent, that it can do nothing wrong, and no matter what the parent does, they love them unconditionally. Yeah. Whereas the left would look at this country as an adult, and you love your parents and you respect them, but if they mess up, you're going to call them on it. And I think if we just transfer that to, you know, the story we tell ourselves, about this culture and each other, that's really where we are. We've been brought up really as children and to believe in this, you know, exceptionalism no matter what. And to question it really is to question yourself. And that takes you to a place that, you know, it's an ugly place to be sometimes. And, you know, there's a reason, I guess, Guy does grief workshops, because, you know, looking inward like that is really difficult. But, you know, that's the hard work that people that like to expose, or, you know, they like to reinforce that hard work can solve everything. But the real hard work is actually doing that self-reflection.
Well, yes, as an engineer, I have a healthy respect for technology. Mm-hmm. And let's say that there was some magic pill that was going to fix exactly what it is that we're going through right now. Well, I would be out in my garage working on it. Or I would be doing something in order to fix this paradigm. But the fact of the matter is that there is no technology out there. And I'm going through it all. I went through the whole solar cell panels and hydro and, well, we'll find this or we'll do that. And then once you start digging into it, and total honest, just being totally honest with yourself, you realize, no, in order to get the resources for solar cell panels, well, we're still going to need oil and gas to do that.
Yeah.
A car, just to bring it to market, if I remember correctly, is 25 to 50 barrels of oil. You know, there's X amount of gallons in the tires. So it isn't like you're going to take a solar cell panel and be able to make tires out of that. No, you need oil and gas, plastics, oil and gas. Things that we have just become, just have thought as just being natural. No. It takes resources that are only a quote-unquote one-time gift from God or whatever it is that you think has placed these things in our lives.
Yeah. So, I mean, really that brings us back to employment. And as you generally refer to it, for those that follow your writing, which I do, you refer to your job as a slave. You know, can't be king of the world if you're a slave to the grind. So maybe you could talk to us a little bit about, you know, and explain that to our viewers.
Sure. The first time I heard somebody describe a job as a slave was in the autobiography of Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. When Malcolm X went from Lansing, Michigan to Boston to stay with his sister, he ran into a guy who was going to help him get a job, and he called it a slave. And I know that there are probably a good amount of people who don't like to use that term as far as a job is concerned. And there's a couple of reasons. Some people feel like it's being disrespectful to the people that were really chattel slavery here in the United States, black people, my forebears. But then also, people don't want to face the fact that if you do use that term, and it's in any way truthful, that means that you haven't experienced the one thing that they tell you that you're going to experience in this country, and that's progress.
Right.
And when you see how we went from the East Coast to the West Coast, it was called progress. When you look at how the native in this country was totally destroyed, it was progress. So to just stay at the same point as you were 150, 160 years ago, shows that you just haven't done anything to quote unquote better yourself. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing though. If you look at slave, let's look at the Keystone XL pipeline. Right. And just really quick for anybody that doesn't know what that is, I'm sure they do, they listen to your show, but it's a pipeline that's going to run from the Alberta tar sands down here to Houston, Texas, and they're going to take the bitumen, which is all of the oil, dirt, and sediment with a little oil in there, and they're going to transport that from up there down here and refine it. Now, the AFL-CIO is for the Keystone XL pipeline. Because they say, like, they're going to have these quote-unquote permanent jobs, with permanent only being about one lifetime. Hopefully some young kid will get a job at 20 years old and then be able to work the next 60 years of his life and hold it down and have a 401k and debt and everything else that comes with it. So that's what they mean by permanence. But here's the craziest thing. The AFL-CIO acknowledges that we're going through climate change. They acknowledge that carbon emissions are a problem. So how can you, in one breath, say, okay, well, climate change is a problem. Yeah. And then in the other breath say, well, yeah, but we need these jobs for Keystone XL, so we're going to support it. So you are a slave. It's just who is your master. We've gone from the slave, someone like me, 300 years ago, being a white man in house, in plantation, and now it's the actual system in and of itself, which will make you do things that are not even in your best self-interest.
Right, because so that is the slave today. The American lifestyle is non-negotiable, as we've been told.
yes. And then you hear people say all the time, and then they say, oh, well, no, George Bush said it. And then, oh, no, or Dick Cheney said it. And, oh, no, Obama said it. No, they all said it. It's a running narrative, right? You can't negotiate that. If you don't, then if my presence was necessary in order to keep the system functioning, then they would keep me around. But one day, it might be tomorrow, it might be 3 years from now, they won't have any use for me, so they'll put me out the pasture.
Right.
And that's everybody. I mean, because once industrial civilization collapses, then no one's going to be of any use, and it'll just be every man for himself. I hate to say that. My greatest fear is that what we're going to see eventually is this dystopian future that's reminiscent of the novel The Road. That's my greatest fear. Not to get too personal, but I mean, one of the reasons that I have decided not to have kids is because, once again, you can learn a lot from fiction if you really read and watch some good stuff. And one good thing that I took away from The Road was there was a scene where the protagonist was a man and his boy, and they're basically trying to survive day by day. There's a scene where they find this house and they think it's abandoned, and then they go in there and then they go into the cellar and they find a whole bunch of people just locked up, and then they realize there's a gang that's taking these people and warehousing them and they'll cut them up and eat them. So when they're about to leave the house, his gang comes back, and the father has a gun and he only has one bullet. And he has to choose between himself or son. So he's like, I'm going to have to kill my son just so he won't have to go through the horror of being eaten like this.
Yes.
And eventually, of course, it is Hollywood, it is fiction, so they find their way out of there, right? But I can't say honestly that one day I wouldn't have to make that decision if I had a child. That's mind-blowing.
And I think that book and the movie and Cormac McCarthy in general, I think what his writing has done for me is it really brought into focus that we are not facing a problem, we are facing a predicament. In his movies, in his books, there is no way out.
Yeah.
You know, that's a pretty bleak, the road's pretty bleak. You know, there's nothing growing anymore on the planet. So when the canned goods are gone, it's over. And he did another movie that had nothing to do with collapse of industrial civilization. I think it was one of his first screenplays called The Counselor. And in it, there's a line that says, I encourage you to see the truth of the situation that you are in. And I think that's really what your writing does, is you're encouraging people to see the truth. And the truth isn't exactly what they want to see, because they're so used to being brought up in a culture that believes it can solve everything.
Well, I mean, that's what we've been taught. No matter where you grew up, I mean, that's just the running narrative here in the United States, in the Western world. But here in America, it's even worse. It's just ingrained in you. Yeah, it's in the DNA at this particular juncture where we always have to be the best, and that means that we have to have more than the next country over. I mean, when you saw Europe rioting, like when Greece had their riots and France was rioting, the running narrative on both sides of the spectrum, on the left and on the right, was, well, they should be doing that. And a lot of it, even from the liberal side, was like, well, they're expecting too much from the government. All right. So over here, we wear this work ethic, which is really only in our mind. You can look at any number of people from the Carnegies, the Mellons. I mean, these people weren't out busting rocks in a gravel pit. Yeah, but the running narrative is that they were just such hard workers, and that's never been the case.
Right. Well, there's that show that's on the History Channel, The Men Who Built America.
Yeah.
Those aren't the guys who built America.
Yeah. I mean, even if you look at the railroads that run across this country, I mean, those are the people that they point to as far as building it, but nobody paid attention to the Chinese that were brought over here and were, quote unquote, allowed to work on these railroads. And then once they were done, they wanted to transport them back. Nobody talked about that.
Right,
but
right.
As far as the indigenous people over here and the blacks and the Latins and all these different ethnicities, all these different people that played a part in the actual building of this country, they get short shrift in modern society. Not even to the history books. I mean, I took history in college, high school, and you know, the whole nine, but yet and still, there are so many people that I never heard about until I did my independent reading that had nothing to do with school. I mean,
yeah, absolutely. You need to literally toss the textbook. I mean, because the textbook is a colossal waste of time.
Yes. I had my stepson, and he mentioned something. He said that, you know what, I've been getting, and it was like Thomas Jefferson and George Washington since grade school. So it's just repetitive. You get the same thing over and over and over and over again. And that's how you get this indoctrinated into you with everything.
Right.
So even the sciences, I'm an electrical engineer, and even the sciences were taught to me not for a love of science or understanding of math. It was always taught to me as a way of, okay, well, get that degree, get that job, and then you're happy.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, speaking of Jefferson and Hamilton and the guys and science in general, last week we had Albert Bates as our guest, and he went down to the UN climate talks in Lima, and then he wrote a piece about it, and he broke down the world generally between Jeffersonians and Hamiltonians, and basically said, you know, those countries and people who see connections between us all, and those basically who are out to get their own or get theirs, so to speak. The global north and the global south kind of fall into these categories, and I know you've written about this on your Facebook wall. In your eyes, what do you see the dynamic being played out in the world between the global north and the global south as climate talks start to, again, you know, ratchet up this year?
It's a relationship where they will always be dictated to by the global, they being the global south, by the global north. There's no other way that relationship can go. If you look at just me sitting here and talking to you on the telephone. the greatest lie that the global North is telling the global South is that there's enough for everybody.
Yeah.
That there is no way. There's no way that you can extrapolate out and take the 100 million barrels of oil it takes to have a functioning economy right now and tell me that you're going to get that to 200 million. Because in all honesty, that 100 million probably serves about, let's say, at most 2 billion. At most 2 billion. Right. You have 7 billion people plus.
Yeah, we add, what, 250 a day, 250,000 a day, death minus, yeah. Birth.
So how is that possible? How is that conceivable? There have to be some haves and some have-nots. And the greatest thing that's happening now is you see that China is trying to direct all of the resources towards that end of the globe. Right? Yeah. And that's their greatest fear. That's why you see them trying to have pipelines land from Russia into China, because they're afraid, like, if they use tankers, which is still the primary way of transporting oil and gas today, is tankers.
Right.
That the United States, who has a superior navy, will cut off their routes. So if China knows that, hey, there's not enough for everybody, we're trying to get all of these resources directed our way, then even China and its relationship with Africa, where they're even telling them, like, hey, if you provide us with oil in Sudan, that we'll be able to get, that's an utter lie. That's an utter lie. They're taking advantage of them also. So everybody's looking for this middle-class lifestyle that we have here in America, but it's impossible for us to keep it going. And I mean, eventually it's going to run out. I have a very good friend of mine who lives in Miami. And even by conservative estimates, 2100, Miami's going to be underwater. Of course, this was a big article in Rolling Stone, and people read that. And then even Rolling Stone, they'd be like, oh, all we have to do is just move more inland. There'll be some easy fix.
Right, that worked out in New Orleans.
Yeah, for this particular problem. Now, the sad part is that if I was to talk to my friend, and this gentleman is college educated, and he has a degree and everything else, but if I sat down and talked with him about everything that's going on environmentally in Miami right now, he'd have no clue.
Yeah.
He'd have no clue. If I went to California right now, which is my home state, and I talked to any number, and some are people that I've known since I was a child and grown up with, family, friends, they have no clue about the water situation in California. Because as long as they're able to go to that tap and turn it on, they're not going to be concerned about anything else. So. Right. If the people over here are under the delusion that everything is going to be okay and everything is fine, then even the ones over here that are hurting will always look towards the global South and say, well, it's something that you're not doing right, because we at least have this little bit.
Right.
You have people in Detroit right now who are getting their water shut off. I think it's like 60,000 right now. It might even be more, because they had put a moratorium on it, but they've started it back up. And they had one lady who got her water turned off, and she said something that was very sad. She said, I only thought that stuff like this happened in Africa.
Right.
So she was totally fine with that as long as it was happening in Africa.
Right.
So if people over here are going through this, then how are the ones over in the global South going to be able to have indoor plumbing? Are going to be able to have 120 volts AC run to their house, are going to have hundreds of power plants in their country. All right. That's inconceivable.
Right.
So right now it's like Michael T. Clare said, it's the race for what's left. That's what we're going through right now. So the global North can never be a partner with the global South in it. Never.
No, and it seems to me that the very little time that I've spent in the global South is that, obviously, the reality is different there, but they're clearly not telling themselves the same story we're telling ourselves. And so do you see, as things deteriorate, do you see the global South in some cases, and I'm talking more on a personal level, being able to cope?
Yes, and what I mean by that is when things go bad in this country, and as we both know, they will go bad when the industrial civilization will collapse. The ones that are going to be most ravenous will be the people in the middle class, because they have been indoctrinated into thinking that they will have something.
Yeah.
It is the ones in the global South, or even here in America, who are in the inner cities and who live paycheck to paycheck. Those are the ones who will find some way to survive. They will somehow bandy about and get everything going mentally and go, okay, well, we need to stick together and we need to do this. Because right now, even all the crime-ridden places that you see here in the United States, it's only because they need money. They need some form of cash or a currency in order to buy food, water, and all that. Well, once collapse happens and you can't get anything with money, it'll just be green paper, then you won't have any reason to shoot the guy down the street. You won't be worried about that quarter block that you're trying to sell crack or whatever it is. It won't be a problem, you know. And those are the people who, in all honesty, I would suggest anybody try and beat around, because they'll have no reason to take advantage of it. But the middle class, and to be specific, middle class white America, right? Those are the ones who are going to be most rapacious when it comes to, okay, well, blaming people. I mean, you've seen it now. You've seen it where even the Tea Party, they have been very violent. As bad as things are for black people in this country, and they've been like that for a long time, you've never seen us take AR-15s to a Ronald Reagan rally, to a George Bush rally, a Bill Clinton rally, or any of these places. But yet still, and then part of it is racism, but then also a big part of it is that middle-class white people are starting to really be afraid of losing their privilege.
Well, so, absolutely. I agree. I think that when things start to really deteriorate, that's when white, middle-class, privileged America and up will realize the entitlement that they've actually had, that they've been accusing of others always wanting.
Yes.
They never feel that they're entitled. They are entitled, but they never feel that it's about them. They always feel about, you know, people that are further down the socioeconomic ladder than they are. You know, these particular people feel entitled, and it's completely the opposite.
Well, they've been taught that. As I say all the time, white, and specifically white male supremacy, is something that's been indoctrinated into this culture. It's so ingrained. I don't see any way out of it. I don't see any way out of getting people to understand that, okay, well, this particular people should live on this earth also.
Right.
Because what the middle class did, and really is just a manifestation of World War II and the policy that came out of that, and by, let's say, 1950 to about 1970, you started seeing urban blight, right? So we keep trying to get just what was really just a 20-year period, right? And you can even make the argument that it was really only like 1950 to 1960, where you just had this total Leave It to Beaver, Ozzie and Harriet utopia that people just still look fondly upon. And in all honesty, you find people of all different class levels and ethnicities that are seeking that also.
Yeah.
As Bill Cosby is really prominent in the news right now, the fact of the matter is that that is how he made his millions, off of a television show that proposed that if you did these specific things, even you as a black person in this society can have that 1950s lifestyle.
Oh, and, you know, and white folks ate that show up, you know.
Yeah, because, well, it's showing that you become humanized.
Right.
So it's like, okay, well, we did all these different things to black people, so now it was for their better good, right? It made them better people. We humanized, right? So, and I'm not going to get into all the particulars of Bill Cosby and any problems that he has right now, but that show really was Ozzie and Harriet. The kids.
Yes.
What was the most difficult thing they had going on in their life? What shoes to wear to some dance or something like that.
Right. Yeah.
You know,
shoes.
And that, I'm like, this is something that you would see on Leave It to Beaver. And that isn't even to say, like, everything that should be shown on television as black should be, like, downtrodden or killing or maiming or everything in the inner city. But that being said, you should be talking about more important things, even if it's a sitcom, because what is it that we learned from that entire 1950s middle-class area? Suburbia is what is killing this world. It is killing this world. And that's what people don't want to face, because they want their piece of the pie. They had theirs, we want ours.
Well, on that note, this culture is clearly a sitcom. I got through about three questions with you, so down the road we're going to have you back on and finish the interview, but we're running out of time here. I appreciate what you do for the show and what you do for the world. I'm a big fan, and I look forward to having you contribute all of next year. Thanks for being on the show, Forrest.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it.
All right. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Well, folks, that about wraps it up for this week. Make sure you like us on our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network. And join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. Feel free to post questions you'd like to address on the show, and please continue to follow Guy's blog at GuyMcPherson.com for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. Guy was en route today, so I did the show by myself, but he should be back for our next show, and we will be doing it again together. So we'll see next time, next Tuesday on the radio. If you missed the show, make sure you find us on the archives at PRN.FM. And rate us on iTunes. Thanks again to all the excellent contributions this week and to Aphrazin and Rianne for the music. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end, nature bats last. Yeah.